time we think the crisis is over, something else happens.
Join us and hear the world.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. The Obama administration announced yesterday that 5 million Americans have now enrolled in the Affordable Care Act, and that might be surprising news for some who tried to sign up and were met by major website problems early in the rollout. If you are not one of those 5 million, you still have about 2 weeks to sign up or figure out if you might be able to stay in a plan you already have. Now, we realize that sounds complicated. So to help us sort it all out, we've called once again on Mary Agnes Carey. She is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and she's been joining us from time to time to talk about the Affordable Care Act and other issues in healthcare. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, tell us about this deadline coming up in 2 weeks. Who needs to pay attention to it?
If you don't have health insurance right now, and or you currently have insurance but it's up for renewal, you need to look at some of the options that are out there. March 30th is in your enrollment deadline. If you don't enroll, March 31st rather, if you don't enroll in health insurance by then, you could face a penalty. It's $95 or 1% of income for the first year. People forget about that 1% of income because it's whichever is higher. So this is the time now to get on the website, look at the options. You might qualify for a subsidy. You might qualify to be in the Medicaid program if your state is expanding Medicaid. So now is the time before the end of the month.
How is the government going to figure out if you signed up, if you should have signed up and didn't?
You're supposed to say on your tax return whether or not you signed up. And also insurance companies are supposed to tell the government who they've signed up. So through a reconciliation process, when you file taxes in 2015, they're supposed to know who is signed up and who isn't.
Now, the White House wanted to give some consumers more time to stay with plans that do not comply with the health law. Many people might remember a big to-do last year when a number of plans that didn't meet all the requirements of the new law started dropping people, and people were upset about this. So the White House wanted to give people more time to stay with these plans, even if they don't conform to the requirements of the law. And this was part of a revision that included some other changes. Is there something we really need to know right now about that?
Well, there's a couple of things. To your point, back in November, we want to remember that President Obama said if you were in a health insurance plan that didn't comply with the Affordable Care Act, and your health insurance plan wanted to still offer it. These are plans in the individual market. If the insurer would offer it, the state would allow it, you had an extra year. So earlier this month, they said, we're going to make that 2 extra years. Again, the insurance company has to continue to allow it. The state has to continue to allow it if the insurance commissioner has that kind of leeway. This big rule that you're talking about that came out earlier in the month also extended the enrollment period for 2015. It'll start November of this year, November 15th of 2014, through February 15th of 2015. That's an extra month they had previously allotted. There's also some higher limits on cost sharing. And here we're talking about your deductibles, your co-pays, and your co-insurance. Those limits in 2015 for an individual will increase to $6,600 from the current $6,400. And for families, those limits will rise to $13,200 from $12,700.
Now, Kathleen Sebelius, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, told lawmakers this month that the Obama administration would not extend the deadline for people to sign up for health insurance or delay the requirement for most Americans to have coverage. And that's that March 31 deadline that you were telling us about. But what about people who have been dropped from medical insurance plans, you know, for whatever reason, for whatever reason, do they have some leeway there?
Well, if you have been, your health insurance was canceled and you need to look for another option, if you can find an option that you can afford, you'll be fine. If you find an option, you can't find an option rather that you deem as affordable, you can apply for one of these hardship exemptions. But this is causing some controversy because opponents of the law are saying the way that some of these hardship exceptions are drafted, it's basically a big truck that anyone could drive through and avoid the mandate. So there is some flexibility if people have had their plans canceled and can't find one that they deem as affordable for them.
Well, tell us about what you're seeing just as you're reporting this. I mean, one of the things that's been interesting about this throughout the course of this big new law being rolled out is what seemed to have been kind of some unexpected potholes, something that's all on our minds right now as we're still cleaning up from our last kind of snowstorm. So are there any other kind of interesting kind of potholes or corners of this that have emerged that perhaps were not anticipated?
This conversation over what a narrow network is, this is something that started before the health law, but it's continued to happen as the exchanges, these online marketplaces have been rolled out. Do the health plans have enough access to doctors and hospitals, for example? That's something that is starting to emerge as an issue that we didn't really think about a lot before. I think it's interesting how confused people still are. We find this constantly in our reporting and questions that are sent to us at Kaiser Health News. People don't understand the basic rules of the road with the health law.
What are they confused about?
They are confused about how to enroll. They're confused about how the subsidies work. They may live in a state where the governor and or the legislature has decided not to expand Medicaid, and they might qualify for that expansion. And so they want to get a subsidy and purchase coverage. But if they're below a certain income level, they can't do it. There's a lot of twists and turns in this law that people are confused about. I know we're trying to explain it. You're certainly trying to explain it, but that a lot of confusion still remains.
What do you recommend to people? Because obviously we can't, as much as we would like to, you can't, as much as you would like to, answer every question that people might have about this. So what do you recommend that people do? Is there a first place that they should go to just get some basic things answered?
There's a variety of things they can do. Healthcare.gov is a pretty good website in the sense of answering questions about the law. I know people have had a hard time navigating that system, but I have found that website is pretty good. There are nationwide networks of assisters, navigators. These are people created, positions rather, created in the health law to help you understand the health law. Can you find some place in your community, a senior center, for example, any kind of community outreach that can help you enroll in the health plan? Do you know anyone who sells insurance? Do you know a broker? Do you know an insurance agent? Go there to try to get questions. If there's a particular health insurance company that your neighbor uses, for example, see if that insurance company has information for you. And also, if your state is doing a health insurance exchange, you can find out healthcare.gov. You can go there.
Mary Agnes Carey is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. We want to tell you once again that is a news service and it is not affiliated with Kaiser Permanente. And she was kind enough to join us once again in our studios in Washington, D.C. Mary Agnes, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you.
Now we'd like to remember the life of a man who expanded the American political landscape in ways that are still felt today. Former Florida Governor Reuben Askew died recently at the age of 85. He was a Democrat who served as governor in a largely conservative Florida in the 1970s. While in that office, he took a progressive stance on racial equality and pushed through legislation to overhaul ethics and taxes. He went on to serve as a U.S. Trade Representative in the administration of another progressive Southern Democrat, Jimmy Carter. We wanted to learn more about his life, so we've called Ken Rudin. He is the host of the Political Junkie radio show on PRX. Ken, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
What was he like?
Well, I met him in 1984 when he was running for president. I met him in New Hampshire. And even then, apparently, he was exactly the way he was when he was governor. He was unassuming. He was kind of an aw shucks guy. He wasn't the kind of guy who would want attention to himself, but he believed in his ideas about economic fairness and racial equality, and he wanted to talk about that. But, of course, he did awful in New Hampshire in 1984, finished ninth place and last place and dropped out of the race. But even then, you just see why people in Florida loved him so much. He was just a good guy, an unassuming guy who just wanted to do the right things.
You know, you look at the legacy he left. He appointed the first black justice of the Florida Supreme Court. He raised welfare benefits. He appointed the first black person since Reconstruction to head a state agency. And on the tax side, as you know, mentioned, he pushed through a 5% corporate profits tax. He eased consumer property and school taxes. I mean, some people just see these all as minor miracles, given the political landscape of the time. How did he do all that?
Well, what's remarkable, not only did he raise the taxes and raise corporate taxes, but he campaigned on that theme. When he first ran for governor in 1970, that was his campaign on tax fairness, on the fact that corporations are just making obscene profits. That sounds like something that, you know, is a left-wing fantasy campaign, but he ran on it. First of all, he had the good fortune of running against the old boys in the Democratic primary, and he had the good fortune of running against a very erratic Republican governor, Claude Kirk, in the general election. But again, he would never talk nasty about any other candidate. He just talked about the issues. And even though he was quiet and sometimes aloof and reserved, he was a leader, and Florida voters twice rewarded him with his leadership by electing him overwhelmingly.
One of my favorite stories about him, even though I never got a chance to meet him, was in his 1970 gubernatorial race, his opponent commenting on the fact that he didn't drink, smoke, or swear, called him a mama's boy. And he apparently solemnly replied to this, "I love my mama." And I just wanted to ask you, could you talk to me a little bit about that? Did his personal rectitude inform his politics? I'm just so curious about how all that.
Well, let me go to back another story. This is Pensacola, 1958. This is closer to the Brown versus Board of Education decision, campaigning for the state house for the first time. And a heckler yells out at him, "You're an N lover," and asks you, takes him aside and says, "Look, the trouble is I don't love them enough. The difference between you and me is I'm trying to overcome my prejudices and you're not." This is Pensacola in the panhandle. Reuben Askew was not a showman on race or anything like that. He just wanted to do the right thing, and it just came from his inner faith.
How would you want him to be remembered?
Well, look at what the South was like in 1970. The governor of Georgia was Lester Maddox. In Arkansas, Orville Faubus was seeking a comeback. I mean, they were really the old redneck Democratic regime was ruling in the South. And then you had Jimmy Carter elected in Georgia, you had Dale Bumpers elected in Arkansas, and you have Reuben Askew elected in Florida. He helped move Florida into the 20th century. Of course, this was a bit late. This was 1970. And he had this decency and leadership that Harvard University decided to rate him as one of the 10 greatest governors of the century.
Ken Rudin is host of Political Junkie on PRX, and he was kind enough to join us from his home office in Maryland. Ken, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Coming up, these days, most girls and young women get plenty of personal time with their computers or phones, but how do you make sure they know about the technology that makes them run? Our parenting panel talks about how they got their daughters to fall in love with science and technology. It's part of our Women in Tech series, and it's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
On the next Fresh Air, a story of cannibalism and colonialism. Journalist Carl Hoffman investigates the disappearance of 23-year-old Michael Rockefeller from off the coast of New Guinea over 50 years ago while on an expedition to collect primitive art. Hoffman's new book is called Savage Harvest. Also, an interview with saxophonist and composer Marty Ehrlich. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Tune in to WILL-TV and catch up on Season 1 of the hit PBS show Mr. Selfridge. This miniseries dramatizes the real-life story of Harry Gordon Selfridge, the flamboyant and visionary American that revolutionized the modern shopping experience with his famous London department store. Created by Andrew Davies, the series stars Jeremy Piven in the title role. Watch Season 1 of Mr. Selfridge all this week on WILL-TV.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms and dads in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. This March for Women's History Month, we've been talking with women innovators, entrepreneurs, and educators in the STEM fields. Once again, that's science, technology, engineering, and math. It's for our Women in Tech series. And feel free to dip into that anytime you like at hashtag NPRWIT. Now, we've been asking people why women continue to be underrepresented in these fields and what can be done about it. Now, of course, people disagree about whether it's self-selection that takes girls and women out of STEM or whether they are pushed out. But one thing just about everybody seems to agree on is to get more women and girls involved, you have to start early. But how do you do that? We wanted to talk about this, so we've called Rachel Levy. She is an associate professor of mathematics at Harvey Mudd College in California. She founded the blog Grandma Got STEM, and she's a mom of two. One of those two is her 17-year-old daughter, Mimi Combe, who is also with us. Mimi is a senior at Claremont High School who plans to study engineering, and Iman St. Jean is an educational technologist and founder of the Help Circle app. She's a mom of two daughters as well. Welcome to you all. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to be here.
Yes, thank you so much.
So, Professor Levy, let me start, because we often tell guests to explain complicated stories in a way, say, your grandma can understand. And hearing that from other people actually inspired the title of your blog, Grandma Got STEM. And briefly, tell us a little bit about it and why. Mm-hmm.
Sure. It's a blog where each post features a woman who's made a contribution in science, technology, engineering, or mathematics. Sometimes it's the woman telling her own story, and sometimes it's a family member or a former person that she has mentored or someone who's worked with her who tells her story for her. Each post has a picture and then a story. And even though it started to respond to people who might have said, grandmothers don't know very much or explain things so your grandmother might understand it, it's come to play a different role. People are really learning about their own families, learning about the people they work with. And I'm hoping to have a new group of junior reporters, some girls who will interview women in their communities in STEM and send posts to the blog for us to feature.
Well, why do you think that that's important to do? I mean, is it, I know that I think it was Toni Morrison who said you can't be what you can't see. Or maybe it was Maya Angelou, exactly. But is that it? It's just you've got to put these role models out there where people can see them.
I think that's exactly right. And I think if these girls are getting out there and interviewing these women and talking to them about their jobs, they'll have more of a sense of what it takes to enter one of these roles and how much fun it can be and how challenging it can be.
Mimi, your mom's a math professor. Lucky. So you were surrounded by this growing up. But you were telling us that it's also your dad, who's a librarian, that helped foster your interest in engineering. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, he is really passionate about biking, and he's worked in bike shops and built bikes. And so he's got sort of a strand of tinkerer in him. And he had the tools around in the shed or the know-how to sort of let me explore the world of building things and making things and creating my own solutions. So that was a big part of why I'm going into engineering, I think.
Can you give us I know you're kind of in the middle of it, but can you identify maybe a story or a moment when you realized, hey, this is pretty good? I mean, did he drag you into the shed with him, or did he just invite you to be there with him? Or is there something in particular that you can point to that helped, that encourage you?
I don't think there was any dragging happening.
I know that sounded awful now that I think about it. I'm sorry. There's an image, fine. I really didn't want to.
No.
But I bet, you know, sometimes it's like there's the clean your room invitation, or then there's the, hey, let's clean our room. You know, there's that. That's what I meant.
Yeah, I think he encouraged me to take wood shop in middle school. He encouraged me to help when he was building things. So when he was working in the shed, he would always encourage me to come help. Or if he was working on the barn or doing work around the house, it was always, you want to come help me with this. And I think I learned a lot of practical skills, but I also sort of caught his enthusiasm for that sort of thing.
Ima, what about you? Your daughters are 8 and 12. What do you think makes a difference in encouraging girls to take an interest in these things?
Well, I agree. I believe that early exposure and as much exposure as possible is really important in getting them interested and getting them hooked. Also, making it relevant and making it fun. A lot of times we forget that this should be fun. And we understand as adults the real world implications of knowing these skills and knowing these opportunities. But at a young age, at like 8 for my daughter, I have to make it fun. I have to make it relevant. And those are some of the things that I do.
Iman, can you help me, though, with, I'm thinking about a lot of women who had either limited exposure to these fields or areas because people didn't think it was important, you know, when they were growing up to expose them, or they even had horrible experiences in these fields because people told them, oh, that's not for you, or, mm-hmm. you know, nice girls don't do that, you know, that kind of thing. And I just wonder how, given that you feel like it's really important for the parents to encourage, how do you encourage people in something that you may not know a lot about yourself? Can you help me with that?
Right. Well, that's where the village It Takes a Village to Raise a Child comes in, because right now in Oakland, there's so many opportunities, so many events, hackathons, communities, people giving back that are really interested in raising awareness and getting people involved. And so it's not just me, but also a lot of others. It's a community effort that's going on right now. And if anyone pays attention at all, you'll see that there's a trend towards technology, digital literacy, media literacy, coding, programming, and of course, all of the job opportunities that are present and will be even more in the future. So really, all you have to do is just pay attention and become aware, and you'll see innumerable opportunities to get involved, to learn, and to participate, and even volunteer. If you don't see yourself as a coder or a programmer or a web developer, Black Girls Code and other organizations are asking for volunteers to just come and help out, come and help other people learn. And that's another way to...
I see what you're saying. Professor Levy, what about that? I mean, what about people who don't or aren't parents like you, who are tech savvy, who are comfortable, you know, in this realm, but still want to encourage and inspire their daughters? You have some thoughts about that?
I think that if you are able to have dinner as a family or any meals or hanging out in the car, going places, and you're just able to be curious about what's around you, something we're really lucky about is you don't have to go to the library and pull out the encyclopedias, right? Because most people have some access to the internet, and many, many questions can be answered. So I guess I think any parent and their kids can look at the world and wonder about it. I'm an applied mathematician, so I think of the whole world as opportunities to create mathematical models about what's around us. But in a more simple sense, I can just ask questions like, how did that work? Or why does that happen? Or can I understand this? And then just begin with the kid to explore those ideas. You don't have to have all the answers, but it helps if you seem curious about asking the questions along with your kids. And kids ask the best questions. So just encouraging that and saying, wow, that's a great question. Let's try and figure that out. And then, like Iman said, just go find somebody that can help you answer it, or go to the computer.
If you're just joining us, we're having a weekly parenting roundtable. We're talking about encouraging girls and young women in science, technology, engineering, and math, the so-called STEM fields. Our guests are tech educator Iman St. Jean, math professor Rachel Levy, that's who was speaking just now, and her 17-year-old daughter, and aspiring engineer Mimi Combe. Mimi, I was hearing that, you know, mathematical and engineering skills aren't limited to doing things on the computer, that you also apply them in real life, for example, crocheting. And I understand that. Tell me that story, that you needed a crochet hook, and then what happened?
Well, we didn't have one, and I don't drive, so I went out to the garage and found some wood and made one and brought it back in because I needed a certain size that we didn't have. And that's sort of every day for me. I don't consider that if I don't have something, I need to go to the store for it. And I think that's a great attitude for anyone at all, and especially people going into the STEM fields, is that I can make my own solution to this problem. I don't need to buy it. I don't need someone to hand it to me. I'm going to sort of rise to this challenge and solve this puzzle.
You're a tinkerer.
Yeah, yes.
You're a tinkerer, kind of like your dad. Have you anything else that you've applied your tinkering mind to that you want to tell us about, or that anything you're working on now? It's not proprietary. That's not secret.
Lately, I've been doing a lot of sewing, and I make my own patterns, mostly for stuffed animals, occasionally for clothing or things I need, like a school bag. But that sort of, it's more geometrical, I think, but the patterns is really interesting to me because I get a sort of 2D idea, and I make it into a 3D idea.
Professor Levy, I'm kind of intrigued, the whole question of tinkering and allowing girls to tinker and get their hands on things. I'm wondering if that's part of the issue is that, and forgive me, I'm generalizing here, but is it part of the problem perhaps that, you know, girls, that boys are allowed to break things? If they want to understand how something works, they're allowed to break it. Whereas,
I think that,
and take
I
it
think
apart,
that's right?
Right? Mm-hmm. And if a girl does that, it's like, oh, you know, you should be neat. You shouldn't mess things up. Right? I don't know. Do you want to pick up the thread there?
Yeah, I think you're really hitting on something incredibly important. Anyone in science, technology, engineering, or math fails all the time. and we learn from our failures. Iteration, doing things over and over, trying to make them better, is part of any creative process. And so when our kids make a mistake or break something or do something not quite right, there's a lot of different ways to react to that. And I think if someone's going to be in one of these fields, they have to persevere through failure. And that's what we want to encourage in our kids. So I think it's both, okay, that was great. Can we make it better? That iteration approach. But I think also it's, oh, that didn't go well. Well, all right, it didn't go well. Let's pick it up and try again. And I think discouragement, if you think about mathematics, there's so many people who say, I can't do mathematics. I don't believe there's anyone who can't do mathematics. It just means they hit a wall at some point and then felt like they couldn't try again. And then they gave up. And our whole society said, it's okay to give up. So if we're really going to raise kids in STEM, we have to help them understand that is just part of the process. If you're a mathematician, you're going to go to work and you're going to fail most days. Mm. You know, if you're an engineer, you're going to go to work and you're going to fail most days. And I think helping kids understand that, to embrace failure and to see that as part of the road to success, can help them.
Yvonne St. John, do you have a story yourself about how you got interested in these fields yourself?
Well, as an educator, I noticed that a lot of the educational tools and resources were going towards technologically based platforms. And so if I wanted to keep my job and be a part of a forward moving team, I needed to get more tech savvy. And so on the road to that, I got my daughters involved. I tapped other resources and family members who were already there. And I did everything that I could to learn and learn quickly. And as Rachel mentioned, not be afraid of failure, not be afraid of rejection even. And even the hackathon that my daughter and I entered was totally new. And I noticed that a lot of others who were in tech had never even really attended a hackathon. And Startup Week in Oakland, Black Male Achievement Hackathon, coordinated by Kalima Pryforce and Ayori Selassie, created an opportunity and an environment where people from all ages and all backgrounds could come and hack together on issues that were relevant and important to them. And since then, my life has taken off in the tech field, and I've just been really, really supported and welcomed, and it's been amazing.
What's your best advice, Yvonne St. John, for people who still feel intimidated? I mean, they certainly want the best for their kids, because, you know, who doesn't? But they still feel intimidated themselves. In fact, maybe their kids are more technologically savvy than they are, and they're not sure how to inspire and encourage them. Advice?
Yes, I say shrug it off. And I'm working on my master's in education at San Francisco State University, and I'm creating curriculum for my college professors who are heavily lecture-based, and they don't use LinkedIn or Twitter or other platforms that can help enhance learning. And so a lot of them tend to be very afraid of new technologies and different kinds of technologies. And so I just, you know, ask them to just release that for a minute. And I also do this with my daughter and introducing her to new environments and new skills. You know, just relax, breathe, you know, some mindfulness, and prepare yourself to learn something new that is going to be fun and interesting and relevant. So when you hook people in by saying, this is something you need. I learned of a hackathon called Digital Jam 3. It's a hackathon going on in Jamaica right now. And their quote is, the future of work is digital. And I believe that. A lot more jobs will be digital. A lot of more jobs will be tech heavy. And so you have to be open to it and embrace it and be critical as well. Okay. What you don't like, what you don't enjoy, you know, express that. But try to be open to learning new things and just kind of shrug off the anxiety that comes with learning something new.
Okay, Mimi, I'm going to ask you to have the final word here. No pressure at all. But do you have any advice for people who would like to encourage the girls like you to get more involved in tech?
I think the most important thing is to just provide the environment. So the time, the tools, the encouragement, the resources, whatever you can give them to really enable them to explore new things and maybe STEM isn't their cup of tea, but at least they will have had those experiences. And finding them role models is really important as well.
Mimi Combe is a senior at Claremont High School. Rachel Levy is an associate professor of mathematics at Harvey Mudd College in California. She founded the blog Grandma Got STEM, and she's a mom of two, including Mimi. Both are with us from member station KPCC in Pasadena, California. Iman St. Jean is founder of the Help Circle app and a mom of two daughters. She was with us from San Francisco. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, when Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie published her first novel at the age of 26, she thought she had to be drab to show she was serious about her craft.
When I started off, I just realized, you know, if you're female and you're serious, you're supposed to pretend that you don't look in the mirror.
No more. Today, her style is as bright as her literary successes. We'll talk about all of that and her latest award that's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, on the web at hewlett.org. From Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair, with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, at pewtrusts.org. And from Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate. This is NPR.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, the music of London-based Clean Bandit, dance music with a classical twist. Next time on Here and Now, from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays, starting at noon, on AM 580.
We're a thousand miles from comfort. We have traveled land and sea.
Are you a fan of the show, Says You? Would you enjoy an hour of bluff and bluster, words and whimsy, live and in person? If so, you're in luck, as host Richard Scherr is bringing Says You to the U of I campus on Friday, May 2nd at 7:30 p.m. And we're excited to announce that WILL Radio will be hosting a special reception beforehand where you'll have a chance to meet with Scherr and his panelists. For more information on how you can attend and get premium seats for the show, go to will.illinois.edu.
Support comes from the Auto Mall of Champaign on Moreland Drive, a new car alternative offering hundreds of late model vehicles, including luxury sedans, family minivans, and SUVs. A listing of cars and trucks available is on the web at automallofcu.com. The Auto Mall invites you to join them in supporting WILL.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Now, if you are part of a book club or keep an eye on the latest movie releases or even listen to Top 40 radio, then you've heard the name Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie in the last year. The Nigerian writer has just won a prestigious National Book Critics Circle Award for her novel Americana. It is a love story centered on race, identity, immigration, and hair that spans three continents. Meanwhile, a film based on her previous award-winning book Half of a Yellow Sun, starring Oscar-nominated Chiwetel Ejiofor, will be out this summer. And her 2013 TED Talk, We Should All Be Feminists, resonated around the world. It was even sampled on Beyoncé's hit song, Flawless.
We teach girls that they cannot be sexual beings in the way that boys are. Feminist, a person who believes in the social, political, and economic equality of the sexes.
Even after such a remarkable year, though, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's rise in pop culture consciousness is long overdue for many. She's been described as one of the best writers of her generation since publishing her first novel, the critically acclaimed Purple Hibiscus, at the age of 26. And Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie is with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations on everything.
Thank you.
You know, you've had such a remarkable year. Is there something that stands out to you?
Huh, interesting. It's very lovely to be here, can I just say? I'm such a fan of Tell Me More. It's ridiculous. And I have to tell you a story about, I'm mostly in Nigeria now, and I download the podcast. And I didn't realize that my phone service in Nigeria had this thing where if you download podcasts, your money just goes really quickly. So I'm holding you responsible for having to pay extra for my data in Lagos.
I'm sorry. And, I think. Thank you, and I'm sorry.
I don't know that there is. I think in general, I've just been so pleasantly surprised by how well Americana has done because I didn't think it would do particularly well.
And really? Why?
Because I wrote it as my, you know what, this is the book I want to write kind of thing. And I'm still getting royalty checks from Half of a Yellow Sun. So I thought I was doing okay and I didn't have to worry about Americana not doing well. It's a book that I deal with race in a way that's not the way that one is supposed to in serious literary fiction in this country. And I just imagine that maybe many readers would not connect to it.
Why? Because it wasn't so, so serious in the way that, say, Half of a Yellow Sun and other previous books are set against a backdrop of political and economic instability and kind of weighty issues. Is that because you think that that's what people expect?
Well, or, I do think Americana is serious. Right? I think that race is a very serious subject, but I also wanted to poke fun at it. I wanted to poke fun at so many things, so many ideas, one of which is the idea of self-censorship in this country and the way you're supposed to talk about certain things and the things you're not supposed to say. And so I think there's a bluntness about the way that the character writes about race that I felt might make people uncomfortable. And one of the things about the U.S., I think, is that in general, people want to be comfortable.
It's interesting because I think many Americans see themselves very differently, which is one of the things that you actually write about in the book, is that how differently, just for those who do not know, the central characters are a young woman who comes to the U.S. and becomes a very well-known blogger. Yes. And writes about some of these things. And her boyfriend is not able to come, even though he loves the United States, but for various reasons in the post 9/11 environment, isn't able to come. And he goes to England and then eventually goes back to Nigeria. And then she goes back and they're reunited. And it's really a commentary on all these three places. Yes. And do you mind talking about that a little bit, about the difference between the way you think they see themselves in what you actually see?
I want to start by saying I like America very much, but there's the general story America tells itself of being very free and having freedoms, which is true to an extent, but I think people learn in this country not to say certain things, or they learn to talk about certain things in particular ways. And I was struck by that when I first came here, because it took a while for me to understand why you had to pretend that certain things were not as they were, if that makes sense. And there's a part in the novel that's loosely based on an experience I had where I went into a shop very early on in my time in America, and there were two people there who were helpers in the store. One was black, one was white. And apart from that, everything else was the same. They both had very long hair. They both wore black. And when the cashier asked me, "Who helped you?" And I couldn't remember her name. And then the cashier said, "Was it the one with the long hair?" And I said, "Well, both had long hair." And she said, "Was it the one in black?" And I said, "Both were black." And then she kind of had this sort of horrified expression on her face, because she just didn't want to say what seemed to be the most obvious thing, which is,
was it the black girl or the white girl?
White girl. And I remember just finding this very odd and thinking, why? I mean, now I understand. Now I get America's nuances. But at the time, I didn't. So I just thought, life would be so much easier.
The thing about Americana is that there are so many observations like that, these telling details. And one of the ones that struck me is where you comment that a lot of Americans have so many bathing products, but no washcloth. I have to ask why you noticed something like that. Where's their washcloth? But they have all these bubbles and soaps and liquid soaps. And how on earth did you notice that?
Well, I did because, you know, I come from a culture where you scrub, where, it's, you know, to bathe means you sort of you scrub. And I came to the U.S. and I had roommates for a few years. And I was just truly baffled by this because there were 50 different things in the bathroom, none of which was something one could scrub one's body with.
Scrub very well. I remember that line for some reason. Scrub very well, very well. And then you come here and apparently it's not necessary to scrub.
Right.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Nigerian writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She just won the U.S. National Book Critics Circle Award, a very prestigious award for her novel Americana, her latest. You mentioned that your celebrity, or is it your just comfortableness with yourself, has given you the opportunity to speak out about other things? I mean, you've been writing some essays now that have also gotten attention, making people on both sides of the Atlantic uncomfortable, I would imagine. You wrote an online opinion piece in February denouncing Nigeria's new anti-gay laws to further criminalize homosexuality or to increase the penalties for same-sex conduct. And I wondered, what made you want to write this piece and what reaction did you get?
I wrote it because I was angry. I was upset. It was very personal, my reaction to it. And you know, I mean, it's easy to say I have people I love who are gay, which is true. But if I didn't, I would still have been outraged by it because I just felt it was deeply unjust. And I recognize that I have a voice now in Nigeria. And so I wanted to write it, and I wanted to write it specifically for a Nigerian audience to say, let's actually think about this. Let's talk about this. Right? And the responses I got, I wasn't surprised to get, you know, people telling me that I was possessed by the devil and that kind of thing. But also for every 10 people who said, you know, why did you write this? There are people who actually sent text messages to my family members saying, ask her to shut up. This is very sensitive and she's going to lose her status as a Nigerian role model, blah, blah, blah. And people who said, I used to love you, but now that I know you support gays, I no longer love you. And when somebody told me this, that this was what her cousin had said, I said, tell your cousin I don't want her love, if that's the condition for her love. But, you know, for every 10 people who were very negative in their response, there's been one person who has said, now I'm really thinking about this. And often, because Nigeria is a country where, you know, the word gay is just simply deeply layered with all kinds of nonsense, they will say, I don't support gays, but I don't want this to be a crime, which for me is progress. And so, yes, the I've had those responses and they just give me hope because, you know, I really do think this law has to be repealed. It's just deeply, deeply wrong.
May I ask you, though, you join a tradition of Nigerian artists who have spoken up about issues of public concern, and some of them have paid a high price and have had to go into exile or who have been threatened. And I wondered, do you feel any that you may be paying a price for your willingness to speak out on this issue?
No, I don't expect that. I mean, I realize that writing the piece in itself, I've run afoul of the law because I think it means I'm supporting homosexuality.
Exactly.
Which,
well,
which
that
can
is
give
part
me
of the
10
law.
Years.
Part of the law says that one you're supposed to turn in people who are known homosexuals, and you're not supposed to counsel or give support or aid.
It's so absurd. But I'm not worried. I think that if there is a price to pay, it's that there are people who will no longer consider themselves my fans, which I know is happening. But it doesn't matter that much to me.
On the other side of the equation, some might see this as trivial, but I would like to talk about it. You recently wrote a piece called Why Can't a Smart Woman Love Fashion? And you said that when you first came to the U.S., you learned a lesson in what you call Western culture and felt pressure to seem indifferent to style in order to be taken seriously. And after a certain point, you just decided that you were not going to be bound by that anymore. And I hope you don't mind mentioning that in addition to your elegance of language, you are also known for your extremely fly style, if I may say. And I don't even want to try to capture what you're wearing now, which is just sublime. It's got color. It's got some flair. You've got a scarf kind of thrown on in the way that, you know, French women all seem to know how to do, and few Americans without the help of a website. And so I wanted to ask, what moved you to write this piece?
That's hilarious, without the help of a website. I'm going to steal that for the next novel. You know, I think it was just, I suppose I'm more comfortable with myself. So I have the good fortune that now I am read seriously. When I started off, I just realized, you know, if you're female and you're serious, you're supposed to pretend that you don't look in the mirror in the mornings. And I grew up being told that I had to look in the mirror. You know, my mother made history. She was the first woman to be head of the administrative section of the University of Nigeria. And she was very concerned about her appearance. And she brought all her children up to care about how we looked. And so I came to the US and I realized, you know, serious women were not supposed to. And that if you did look as though you cared, it was a reason to be dismissive of you. And so I joined a circle of people who would often say, oh, you can't take that woman seriously. She wears high heels and eyeshadow. Oh, my God, that sort of thing. And I would join
them.
People
would really say that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think there's something true about a certain kind of expectation. It's that idea that, in a large sense, femaleness means either you're the serious person who tries to approximate the look of a man, or you're the unserious person who looks nice and wears makeup and high heels kind of thing.
Hmm. Have you had a reaction to that piece?
Actually, I have had some people come to events of mine and say the only reason I'm here is to see what you're wearing, which I don't mind at all. I'm like, okay, and maybe at some point you'll read the book.
You, one of the things you wrote about in your piece is that you feel more comfortable asserting your own style and presence. Is it because something's changed where people are less quick to put people into categories?
Hmm. You know, I think I just really have come to understand that life is way too short to pretend to be what I'm not. And, you know, it sounds very new agey and cliched, but I just really want to be my true self. And this is my true self. I think for so long when I would find black shapeless shifts for every event, I was just being false. That was not myself. But I was thinking, okay, I have to, you know, I have to look serious. And
I miss that whole era. I can't even picture you in a black shapeless shift. I don't know how I miss that.
I have a number of photographs. These things hopefully will be burnt. But you know, and I've met women who, since I wrote that piece, have said the same thing to me, which is, I actually like dressing up, but I feel uncomfortable because I don't know what people will think and say. And then I think it's a shame that, you know, I think if women want to dress up, they should bloody dress up and not imagine that that one is going to ascribe all kinds of meanings to the fact that you like to wear a dress that's fitted and high heels. And I think also that there's something disturbing about the idea that somehow you do it for men, which I think is one of the reasons that certain feminists don't like the idea of a woman caring about her appearance. And for me, there's something very unfeminist about that, because I don't do it for men. I do it for myself. And actually, most men don't even get it.
Is there something that you feel that Western feminists can learn from African feminists such as yourself?
I think we can learn from one another. I think in Nigeria, what I find is that while women actively run away from that label, many women in Nigeria are earning the living. But in public, they pretend that they're not, because they play along with the so-called cultural ideas of what it means to be female. So a woman who has a job, who buys herself a car, in public will say, oh, my husband bought me this car. I do find that women in the West have really bought into the idea that somehow they're incomplete without a man. And I don't think that women in Nigeria necessarily think that. Women in Nigeria might think they're incomplete without children, but not necessarily without a man. And I think in the West, men are not raised to think of themselves as incomplete without a woman, in the way that women are raised in the West to think of themselves as.
Interesting. You know, I have to ask you about the whole Beyonce thing, that your TED Talk, We Should All Be Feminists, really spoke to people around the world. It was sampled for her song Flawless. There was this debate over whether she really is a feminist or not. And, you know, because of her attire and, you know, her kind of sexuality and the celebration of her sexuality and so forth. So do you like it or not?
You know, I think...
Your face just did something really interesting when I brought it up, and I'm trying to figure out what that is. So...
No, I think that anything that gets young people talking about feminism is a very good thing. I also think that I have a problem with the idea of feminism as being some sort of exclusive party that someone gets to decide whether you can come. And also the idea that somehow a woman who's comfortable with her sexuality, that there's something wrong with that. I have a problem with that. I think that, you know, a woman who, as long as it's her choice, you know, so that we're taking away sex work that's coerced out of this. But a woman who has the choice, why have we decided that somehow a woman celebrating her sexuality somehow is something bad? Maybe it's that slightly Puritan idea. It's also the idea that sex is something a woman gives a man, and she loses something when she does that, which again for me is nonsense. I mean, I want us to raise girls differently, where boys and girls start to see sexuality as something that they own, rather than something that a boy takes from a girl.
Mm. So what's next for you? I mean, the film version of Half of a Yellow Sun will be on general release this summer. There are rumors that Americana will be headed for the big screen. Can you confirm? We'll buy a ticket now if you tell us.
I can't confirm.
You can't confirm. Well, you know, there's a certain Mexican Kenyan Oscar winner, who I think many people might like to see in another film.
Huh. I don't know. Does she consider herself Mexican Kenyan?
I think so. I'm not quite sure. She was born in Mexico, right?
Yeah.
We don't care.
Her as Kenyan.
You'll claim her as Kenyan. That's fine. I would too. I'm not from Kenya, but I'll claim her as Kenyan Brooklyn.
So, yeah, that makes sense.
I'll claim her as Kenyan Brooklyn. So you can't confirm either. Your face is also doing something really interesting. So
no, I can't confirm.
We don't care.
But you know, I admire Lupita very much, and she is probably going to option Americana. I don't know what's going to happen. Whether it's going to be a film or a TV series, or whether it's even going to happen, because, you know, these things
sure.
take forever.
Do come back and tell us.
I will. Absolutely.
Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie has recently won the U.S. National Book Critics Circle Award for her novel Americana, and she was kind enough to join us in our studios here in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for speaking with us. Congratulations on
Thank
everything.
You. Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.